Hi, everybody. I'm Hal Eisner, and welcome. A friend of mine wrote a book, and it's actually a book about a case that I did some reports on way back when. It was back in 1989 that Kitty and Jose Menendez were killed. Their sons were ultimately convicted. Chapter one of his book is called Nightmare on Elm Drive, which sounds very much like the Freddy Krueger movie. But, you know, the man you're about to hear has spent decades looking into this case, talking to the two guys responsible, Eric and Lyle Menendez, and he has a lot to say. And so we invited him on the show. So I have a copy of your book in front of me. It's called The Shocking Untold Story of the Menendez Family and the Killings That Stunned the Nation, The Menendez Murders. And, you know, we were talking earlier, and we're going to talk all about this case and this story, but as I look at the cover and I see the two brothers, Eric and Lyle, I never really knew until a short time ago that Lyle wore a toupee in the courtroom.
That's right.
What was the story when he was
17 years old, he was about to start at Princeton University, and his father told him, you're going to meet some very important people at Princeton that will be your lifelong friends and contacts in business. So it's very important that you have good hair. So Jose Menendez, his hair was slightly thinning, and Jose Menendez took his son to get a very fancy toupee. And that's just one tiny example of how everything in this family had to be perfect. Jose and Kitty Menendez, it was very important to them that the facade of this family, everything was perfect. They used to do the homework for their sons, and it didn't take teachers long at school to see that the homework was always perfect, and then they'd fail the tests. And so on the outside, this was the perfect all-American family. Father was an entertainment executive making millions of dollars a year. The brothers were nationally ranked tennis players. They lived in a mansion in Beverly Hills. On the outside, everybody wanted to be the Menendez family. But behind the gates of that mansion, it was a very different story.
Take us back to the murders. Take us back, and I know your book gets into great detail on this, but take us back to the hours before the murders.
Well, the brothers testified that there were a series of confrontations in the days just before the murders in which they threatened to go to relatives or go to the police and reveal the molestation that was actually still going on. Eric Menendez was still being molested at the age of 18.
Now, just to give everybody some baseline here, this is what you call intergenerational molestation, where Kitty and Jose, the parents, their parents abused them, allegedly, according to what you're saying.
Right.
And then they carried that down to these boys.
That's right. Well, this was a story. The media portrayed this story initially as a pair of greedy rich kids that killed Ozzie and Harriet on a Sunday night in Beverly Hills. But the real story of the Menendez case is a family story of intergenerational abuse. Jose Menendez was molested by his mother when he was a little boy. Kitty Menendez was molested by a relative when she was a little girl. And this cycle of abuse continued with Eric and Lyle Menendez. But there were 3 years between the arrest of the brothers and when the case went to trial. So for 3 years, the only thing the public heard was greedy rich kids. And the defense made what I consider was a tactical error in hindsight. They didn't go public until 2 weeks before the trial, and they had a very different story. And that was the story of abuse that had been going on in this family.
Let's go back to the murders, though. Let's go back to the hours right before the murders at this Beverly Hills home mansion, really. On Elm Street, I remember a line in your book about the murders on Elm Street as if it was from the movie title, Nightmare on Elm Street, right?
Nightmare on Elm Drive.
Yeah. Right. I read it. So take us back. The boys were supposed to meet some friends at A Taste of Los Angeles, which was a kind of a food fair. They didn't show up. The friends did. Take us there.
Right. The brothers testified that there had been several confrontations in the days leading up to August 20th, 1989. And on the actual day of the murders, there was a very violent confrontation with yelling going on between the brothers and the parents, according to their testimony. And Jose Menendez yelled at his younger son, Eric, go up to your room and wait for me. And to Eric Menendez, that was a code for go up to your room. I'm coming up there and I'm going to have sex with you. And so the brothers, their defense, the public was confused, and they thought that the defense was we were molested, therefore we get a free pass to kill our parents. But the actual legal defense was we were in fear for our lives, and that's why we killed our parents.
But in the home, and I'm trying to get back to this because it was a pretty gruesome murder. The house was splattered with blood. Their neighbors heard gunshots. I want to hear that scene a little
sure.
bit.
Well, what happened was there's a violent argument between the brothers and their parents.
And what time is this, give or take?
This is around 10 o'clock at night. The parents go into a room and close the door, and the brothers believe that the parents are about to kill them. And that's very hard for people to believe that parents would kill children. But in 1989, at the time that these murders happened, there were 300 cases a year of kids who killed their parents. There were 3,000 cases a year in the U.S. of parents who killed their kids. And so the brothers, what's difficult for the public to understand is that kids who have been abused and traumatized their entire lives from the age of 4 or 5 years old, they react differently to you and me. The way that they read signals is different from you and me. Jill Lansing, one of the defense attorneys, said in her closing argument, they read the signals and they read the signals wrong. And what she meant by that was that they thought the parents were going to kill them. And so they went and got guns that they had bought a couple days earlier because for protection. The prosecution, of course, said that this was a premeditated act when they bought two shotguns 2 days before the murders.
So on that at night, and the date of that night was
murder. The night of August 20th, Sunday, August 20th, 1989.
And so the story was that two men came in and started firing, and so many bullets were expended that their bodies were riddled. And
yes.
I think you used some pretty descriptive terms about
shotguns are ugly.
Yeah, shotguns, and these were pump.
Yes,
shotguns that you describe, and so the murder scene itself. Kitty and Jose are in the living room.
They were in a family room where there was a big screen TV that was on. According to the brothers, there had been this violent argument, and the parents went in the room and closed the doors, and they interpreted that as a sign that the parents were about to kill them. And the parents did have guns in the house, but according to the prosecution's theory of the case, the brothers burst into the room while the parents were watching TV and shot them.
Is that the version you buy, that they burst into the room and they started shooting the parents?
Well, they did burst into the room. The doors to the room were closed, but their testimony was that they were in fear for their lives. They thought the parents had guns in that room. They thought the parents were about to kill them. And they were reacting in a way that's difficult for the average person to understand, because when you've been traumatized and abused since you were a young kid, the way you filter everything, the way you react to things is much different than the average person.
So in the minutes afterwards, what happened then? Because police were called out. There's a 911 call. They're not fessing up to this thing, right?
Well, actually, the brothers sat there in the foyer, the entrance area of the house, and they waited for the police to come, because they were certain that, in a neighborhood in Beverly Hills on a sunny night at 10 o'clock, a warm night in August, neighbors had their windows open. They thought that somebody was going to call the police and that they would be arrested immediately.
So the police come.
Well, actually, they sat there for about 15 minutes and nobody came. And so then they picked up all the shotgun shells in the room. They drove up to Mulholland Drive near Coldwater. They dumped the shotguns down a hill. They went off to Santa Monica, and where they were supposed to meet some friends for the Taste of L.A. And they had missed their friends. And then they came back to the house at 11:45. And that's when they called 911 and said somebody killed their parents.
It's interesting. You describe a relationship between a Beverly Hills officer and the two boys, and a trust sort of that the officer was feeling that they could talk to him. But it really took a while to sort of get all the facts together on this, didn't it?
Well, the brothers were emotionally traumatized. And even though, you know, they knew they had done it, just think about that they had done this and then they had gone and dumped the guns, gone out to Santa Monica, and an hour later come in and walked in. And you walk in and you realize what you've done. And the therapists that evaluated them have told me that emotion they were expressing that night was genuine. One of the interesting factoids about the case was that the Beverly Hills police did not perform gunshot residue tests on the brothers.
I read that. I thought that was interesting.
They would have caught them that night. They did perform gunshot residue tests on Jose and Kitty Menendez, which were negative. But they never tested the brothers.
That's because they didn't really suspect the brothers?
They didn't suspect the brothers. They thought their emotion was genuine. They thought they were, you know, completely traumatized. And they did interview both brothers on the night of the murders, but they did not really believe they were suspects.
The question in the trial was whether this was murder or whether this was manslaughter.
That's
and the
right.
The difference is that murder is premeditated. Manslaughter occurs.
With manslaughter, what it means is that you have mitigating circumstances. It's that, yes, we did these killings, but there were these mitigating circumstances. There was this evidence of why. And so what was unusual about the Menendez case, it was not a traditional true crime story. It was never a whodunit. The brothers admitted, the defense admitted several weeks before the trial that the brothers had killed their parents. The question was always why they had done it.
And so you, and I want to sort of, and I want to be very clear here. I've known Bob Rand for a very long time. I would say decades. And we
late 90s.
Yeah, we're friends, and I've known him, and so it's not so much a disclaimer as it is to say that I've seen his passion. I've seen him work on this. This book is the culmination of something that I have heard him talk to me about for a very long time, and so. You and I have talked about the idea that you're on somewhat of a crusade and that this is a passion for you, that you want to do something here, you want to accomplish something here for Lyle and Eric Menendez. What was wrong? What are you trying to do, and what are you hoping for?
Well, that's a bunch of questions, but let me knock them down one at a time. I believe there's a miscarriage of justice in this trial. I believe the resolution should have been a manslaughter, not a murder. It was interesting when the brothers went through a series of appeals, which were all turned down. But when they were at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal in 2005, Justice Alex Kaczynski actually made a statement during the hearing that he believed that there had been collusion between the L.A. County DA's office and the trial judge, Stanley Weisberg, to convict the brothers in the second trial. There were two trials, for people that don't know. In the first trial, most of the women jurors voted for manslaughter. All the men voted for murder. And I interviewed all the men after the first trial, and they told me a father would never do that to his sons. This was 1993, 25 years ago. But in the second trial, well, the first trial also, there was something very unusual. There was a TV camera in the courtroom. And so the trial was being broadcast all over the states on Court TV, and it was also being followed internationally. And so people were obsessed with it. They were following it like a novella. And so in the second trial...
Why was there a second trial? What happened at the first?
The reason there was a second trial was that the jurors could not agree on a verdict. Half of the jurors, everybody agreed that this was a homicide, that a crime had been committed. The jurors could not agree on whether this was a manslaughter or a murder. And so that resulted in a mistrial. There were two juries, one for each brother, and neither jury could agree on a verdict. The defense had put on 65 witnesses, teachers, coaches, families, and friends, and there were eyewitnesses to physical, verbal, and emotional abuse. And from my perspective, that can be just as traumatic to a 5-year-old as sexual molestation.
And you were first assigned by the Miami Herald to come to Los Los Angeles to cover this story.
Right. There were 7 months between the crime and the arrest of the brothers, and I spent 3 days with Eric and Lyle Menendez, and 2 months after the murders, 5 months before they were arrested. They were not suspects publicly. I had no reason to be suspicious of them.
And you weren't?
No. And they told me loving stories about their parents, and then fast forward to March 1990, they're arrested, and I was one of the writers on a cover story for People magazine.
So I mentioned that this has been a passion because you got that assignment. Now, when I get a news assignment to go cover, I cover the news assignment, I move on to the next assignment. You've never gotten off the first assignment, and it's been a case that you have embraced in such a way that you have a strong feeling that these guys were mistreated in the court of law, and it was not a murder but a manslaughter. And so when I say that you're on a crusade, how do you respond to that? You are on a crusade.
Well, my response is I'm being a journalist covering a story, and I feel the mainstream media got this story wrong.
But you're on a crusade, aren't you? You want to see change.
I believe this was a miscarriage of justice. I would like to see there be a review of the Menendez case and the possibility of an appeal.
Now, let's explain why. Because in a manslaughter, you might get 25 years. They've been in jail for how long? Prison?
Eric and Lyle Menendez have been in custody for 28 years and 6 months.
They would have been out if it was a manslaughter.
They would have been out a few years ago.
And now they're in for life. And so your hope is that there can be another trial, a different outcome, and they can be released and have a life.
Yes. And there's something interesting that's going on in California. 2 years ago, the state of California passed several laws that said if you were under 25 at the time of your crime, that you can apply for a review of your case because there have been medical studies that say your brain is not fully developed under the age of 25. But unfortunately for Eric and Lyle Menendez, the new laws do not apply if you have been sentenced to life without parole, which really makes no sense at all.
Yeah, it doesn't. But laws aren't always retroactive. They don't always go back to sometime in the past.
These laws were retroactive, but because the law said that the law did not apply to people who were sentenced to life without parole.
So is that, can that be a basis of appeal?
I think it could be. I think it's one possible issue that could be brought up.
In your book, you also have some new evidence.
Yes. One of the pieces of new evidence that I discovered just last spring was that Eric Menendez, 8 months before the murders, wrote a letter to his cousin Andy Cano talking about the molestation. He was worried every night that his father was going to come down the hall asking his cousin for advice. And Andy Cano was a key witness at both trials, because when he was 10 and Eric was 12, Eric told him about the molestation, but he made him swear on a pinky promise that he would never reveal anything. Andy wanted to go and tell his mother right away, and Eric said, "You can't do it. My father's told me if I tell anybody, he'll kill me." And that's quite typical in an abusive family.
So let's talk about the two boys now. They're not boys anymore.
Right, they're men. Eric Menendez is 47 years old. Lyle Menendez is 50 years old. But the funny thing is, because during the trial, Leslie Abramson, the lead defense attorney with the blonde curly hair, always referred to them as the boys. People still come up to me today in 2018 and say, "How are the boys doing?"
Well, we know that Lyle, who wore a toupee as a teenager, doesn't wear a toupee anymore.
That's right.
And he has no hair.
That's right. And Lyle was actually head of the prison government at Mule Creek State Prison near Sacramento, where he was for the past 15 years. There was actually a major event in April 2018. The brothers were reunited after 22 years. They hadn't seen each other.
And that's because they were put in two different facilities intentionally, right?
And in fact, the L.A. County probation report said that they thought it was fine for them to be placed in the same prison. The brothers wanted to be placed in the same prison. And the day before the sentencing in July 96, the Beverly Hills Police filed a motion in which they said the Menendez brothers should be separated because they had conspired to commit a crime, and if they were placed in the same facility, they might conspire again to commit a new crime. And I really believe it was just out of spite. It was just a mean-spirited move by the
police. So how did they get back together again?
Well, the Lyle Menendez had applied for 6 years in a row for a transfer to be reunited with his brother, and remarkably, after being turned down 5 years in a row, the California Department of Corrections approved his transfer in February 2018. And in April 2018, the brothers were reunited. And it was just an incredible moment that they've described to me, in which the first thing they did was they just hugged each other for about 5 minutes without saying a word. And Lyle told me that after 5 minutes, he whispered in his brother's ear and he said, "Finally." And now they are together. They're in the same pod area of...
They're in the same cell also?
No, they're not cellmates. But they're in the same pod area at R.J. Donovan Prison near San Diego. And they're both very involved in their prison communities. Lyle is still continuing his working on activism in reforming California prisons. And Eric Menendez created a hospice program, and he also leads a weekly group on mindful meditation. And so they're both productive members of their prison communities.
And they're both married?
They are both married, and Lyle Menendez is married to an attorney. And Eric Menendez has been married for 20 years to a woman who he met, who was originally a pen pal of his.
No, there are no kids. And
no conjugal visits for prisoners with life without parole. When the Republicans were in office in the mid-1980s, there were several members of the Manson family that had gotten married and had conjugal visits and had kids. And so the Republicans changed the laws. And if you were in for life without parole, the philosophy of a conjugal visit is to try to keep your family together. If you're in for life without parole, I guess they don't care if your family stays together. So the even though some of the Manson family members have had children since they've been in prison, since the 1980s, that law has changed, and no conjugal visits for life without parole prisoners.
I know you stay in touch with these guys. In fact, recently you were with Lyle. You went and spent a few hours with him. How'd that go?
He's a highly intelligent guy. He's very interested in trying to make reforms in California, in the California prison system.
How do you do that when you're in prison?
Well, I mentioned he was head of the prison government at Mule Creek for 15 years.
Is that like
years.
A student council if you were in high school, that prisoners had representatives?
I guess you'd say it's a cousin of being in the student council in school. But he really has, there really are issues, that he's trying to work on. And he has a good relationship with the administration at the previous prison he was at, and he has continued that work at Donovan Prison.
Do you see a day when these two guys will be out?
I hope that there will be that day. It's a long shot. Trying to overturn a murder appeal is, the odds are, very much against it. But I believe there's new evidence, and probably one of the most important things that's happened is the original Menendez trial was in 1993, and here we are in 2018 with the Me Too movement, the Men Too movement, and the recent revelations about the Catholic Church. So I think there's a different climate.
Talk about the Men Too movement. In our conversations recently, you mentioned that a lot, but we don't hear much about that. We hear a lot about the Me Too movement. Tell me a little more about the Men Too movement.
Well, the Men Too movement is really equal to the Me Too movement. Again, it's one of these things that people don't like to talk about. I mentioned earlier when we were talking that I interviewed almost all the jurors after the first trial, and every one of the male jurors voted for murder, and every one of them told me some variation of a father would never do that to a son. And the reality is in 2018, I think people have a different attitude that these things do happen.
It's fascinating that all these years later we're sitting here and we're having this conversation. It really is fascinating because, to think that this has been the core of your professional life for a very long time. And now you're hoping that something will change here because of what you consider to be a miscarriage of justice. And I guess, you know, I'm sort of curious as sort of a bottom line. You know, you have in your title the shocking untold story of the Menendez family and the killings that stunned the nation. But what is untold?
Well, I think the confusion over this case, and, you know, there have been, you know, maybe 100 documentaries since the beginning of the case. People, you know, can't look at this and say it's a traditional true crime story. It's not a traditional true crime story. This is a story about a family that there was intergenerational abuse, a family that was very troubled, but a family that was very good, like many families, at covering up their secrets. And this family happened to live in a mansion in Beverly Hills. This family was wealthy. People looked at this family, a father making millions of dollars a year in the entertainment business, two brothers nationally ranked tennis players, and people thought, boy, I wish that was my family. But what we've learned from this case is that behind the gates of the mansion in Beverly Hills, there can be some dark secrets. And that was the real story of the Menendez family.
Again, the book is called The Shocking Untold Story of the Menendez Family and the Killings That Stunned the Nation, the Menendez Murders. Robert Rand, I'm glad he was able to spend a few minutes with us. Thank you for spending a few minutes with us. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast, and if you have a chance, give us that star, you know, the five-star thing, because we could use a little bit of that support. It's always nice to see. And until next time, we'll see you.